Let us all bring our palms together to make our respectful veneration to the Supremely Enlightened One, the Undefeated One, the Unvanquished One. As we do so, let us remind ourselves that this is not a mere mark of our obeisance or our veneration towards the Buddha. May this be a reminder to us that there is only one path to our salvation. There is only one salvation, and there is no substitute for our practice to get us there. These three things represent the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha. So with that in mind, this is a pledge of our allegiance to the truth, the path to that truth, and the practice that we must all undertake to get there. Therefore, let us chant the Namaskara as a promise that we make to ourselves to be steadfast and to be diligent in our practice. We will then observe the precepts, which will be our protection as we get there. We will then invite the countless sentient beings to join us and witness this meritorious deed, for amongst them will be those who are lacking in merit and therefore do not have the opportunity to listen to the teachings and free themselves from samsara. Therefore, we shall invite them to rejoice in this meritorious deed. And for those with sufficient merits, let us also invite them to listen to the teaching of the great master, understand the Four Noble Truths, and free themselves once and for all from suffering. So with all that in mind, let us make a start to today's proceedings.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
I appreciate your kindness. Thank you. But this is what I've given. So this is what I shall get. What can we do? See, even when you're trying to do something so good, nothing can be better than to deliver a sermon to help individuals, people free themselves from suffering, right? The Buddha says, Sappadanang Dhammadanang Jinati. The supreme, what is supreme amongst all givings is the giving of the Dhamma. And even then, there is no escape. So even if the Buddha had to endure a life that was the life of a saint, if the Buddha had to endure physical pain, derision, scorn, disdain, abuse, assault, verbal as well as physical, then for mere mortals like us. Therefore, I think the best thing to do is just to take it in our stride and to take a lesson from all of this, isn't it? Every experience is a teacher if we are prepared to learn from them. Experiences don't come to hurt us, they don't come to bite us. They come to teach us. But if when we are not prepared to learn the lesson that they are willing to teach us, then we feel that we are the victims. There's only one kind of victim, and that's called the self-victim. All victimization is self-victimization. No one else can victimize you. The universe doesn't punish you. The universe just gives you back whatever you asked for. And how do you ask for something? By giving it. It's like every letter you send it self-addressed. Have you ever done that? You know, just for the kicks, right? Posted a letter to yourself, put your own address and see what happens to it. Just, you know, just for fun. Perhaps when you were a kid you might have done something like that, just to see what happens. The magic of the postal system. I remember at school they got us to do that when I was younger. But then every encounter we have, every dealing we have with nature is an opportunity for us to ask nature what we need from it. We've got to reassess, re-evaluate, relearn how to work with nature. Nature is all we have, isn't it? It's your home. We're actually trying to learn how to live at home, how to live in peace at home. This is what the Dhamma teaches us. So every encounter you have with nature is an opportunity for you. So I want you to think along these lines, okay? Every encounter you have with nature is an opportunity for you to ask of nature what you want from it. Do you not accept my words? Is that not the truth? Every encounter you have with nature is such. A man comes and gives you something, a gift. You say thank you. Wholeheartedly you say thank you. You appreciate them for having given you some thought, having thought about you. So you appreciate them for it. This is an encounter with nature. So nature has decided to give you something. This is an encounter with nature. And at that moment you have an opportunity to ask what you need from nature. Be appreciative at that moment and appreciation will come back to you. Be thankful at that moment. Have gratitude at that moment and gratitude and thankfulness will come back to you. On another occasion, someone comes and tells you off, mocks you, laughs at you. If on that occasion you decide that now it is your turn to retaliate, an eye for an eye, they say it makes the whole world go blind. So if on that occasion you retaliate, this again is an encounter that you have with nature, but if you forget that it is an opportunity for you to ask what you need for, then you will make that request. And for nature, it's always, she's always out there listening to you, saying, okay, what do you want? Just remember that. Whenever you open your mouth, remember, nature is there, having already asked you the question, what do you need? So imagine if you call someone, hey, bitch. You call someone a bitch. What have you just asked nature? You call someone a donkey. You call someone a fool. Not with compassion. You do it with anger. If you do it with resentment. If you do it intentionally to harm, hurt them. So nature is listening to you. And whatever it is you've asked for, nature writes it down. So imagine you're at the restaurant and the waiters come to you. What would you like to have, sir? So whatever you say, they take it down. And then in a moment they say, I'll be right back with you. Please be patient. So they walk away, they go into the kitchen. So the kitchen is where your karma matures. This is where your karma matures. And so once the food is cooked, in other words, your karma has matured, then what is the way to do? It brings it back and serves it to you. Your dish is whatever you had ordered. And the, you know the best thing is, they never get it wrong. At this restaurant, they never get it wrong. I'm not even going to say they hardly get it wrong. They never get it wrong. Sometimes you think, how could I have ordered something like this? Look at how ugly it is. How distasteful it is. I would never have ordered something like this. A person of my stature. A person of my caliber. I would never have ordered something like this. You just don't remember that it's been a while since you placed the order. It took a while to cook it. But you have only ever been served whatever it is you had ordered. You were never served someone else's order. This is the way nature works, ladies and gentlemen. We've got to accept that. The sooner you understand the workings of nature, the sooner you will be at peace with it. Buddhist teaching is to help you be at peace with whatever comes at you. It is not to change the world out there, it is to change the way you respond to the world out there. In your response, you will feel peace. In your response, you will feel war. This is where war and peace live. It's your response. There are some people, the slightest thing makes them annoyed, agitated. It aggravates them, the slightest thing. You may have seen people like that. If you haven't, ask the people you share a house with, a home with. They will have if you haven't. The slightest thing annoys them. They're always on edge. So you have to be very careful when you deal with people like that. It's like walking on eggshells all the time. Blink your eyes if you've come across people like that. Thank you. I can see you're all blinking. They're always annoyed because they feel that the world is out to get them. That's why they feel annoyed. They don't understand that it is they who place this order. They don't understand that. Kamma sakata sammaditti. We have to start there. It's one of the dasa sammaditti. Dasa vastuka sammaditti. That there is such a thing called karma and vipaka. If you deny that there is no such thing called karma and vipaka, then actually hardly any of Buddhist teaching would make sense to you. Because why must you be good? For what reason? If it's simply for the purpose of being good, fair enough. I'm good just because, okay. But once you understand that there are consequences for your actions, that's an incentive. It becomes a real incentive. Then there are others who are so cool, so composed. It takes a lot to agitate them. I mean, there are then others who, it takes a lot to agitate them, but when they're annoyed, that's like a volcano. Like they don't erupt every day, but once it does, it causes a great lot of, it's a catastrophe. Even the cat says so. when your pets know that you're annoyed, like that's a problem at home, isn't it? If only the humans know at home, then fair enough. But when your pets get to know that you're annoyed, then you're just being irrational. You're kicking the dog, throwing things at the cat. That's just being irrational. I mean, that's just being annoyed on another level. We all get there sometimes, but we've all been there. I'm sure we all have been there at some point in our lives, if not this one, in previous lives. So this is a journey for all of us, absolutely. You know, there's no secrets about that. It's all a journey for all of us. So there's no shame per se in being who you are. The shame is if you don't recognize that there's a change that needs to happen within you and that it's possible. If you deny your weakness, that is your shame. That is an embarrassment. If you deny your flaws, if you deny your shortcomings, your shortfalls, that is the embarrassment, not to accept them. In fact, the Buddha says, one who has acknowledged their own weaknesses, by virtue of that, they are an honorable man. Simply by virtue of that. They've not started to make a change, but to accept the problem is half of its all, isn't it? Just to accept the problem. To accept that there is a problem. Can I ask you a question? Do you not know individuals, people, to whom you cannot go walk up and tell them that, or point out their weaknesses? Don't you know people like that? It's blaringly obvious that they have many weaknesses, but you don't feel confident enough to walk up to them. Maybe you tried it once and then you got your fingers burnt. So now it's once bitten, twice shy, you're not going to bother trying again. And even when you've had the courage to walk up to them and tell them, others said, trust me, don't. There were others who told you that. They warned you, trust me, don't. Because it has been tried before, and when it did, they got the sack. Or when they did, they got demoted. Or when they did, they got a real telling off. You may have had experiences where you walk up to people and just, you know, very politely, very respectfully sometimes, you try your best to do, you're doing this because you want to do good by them. And you say, you know, I think there's something I would like to tell you because there's a little slight problem in the way that you handle that particular situation. Sometimes at the end of that you hear these words, who are you? So you heard this, right? What is it? Who are you to tell me what to do and what not to do? You know the mantra. That's good, we live on the same planet then. Who are you to tell me what to do and what not to do? There's another expression that goes very closely related to that. Who do you think, I am? Yeah, who do you think you are, or who do you think I am? Have you heard this or not? There you go. And they call themselves human, intelligent human beings. Once again, I repeat this. It's nothing to be embarrassed that you have weaknesses, flaws, shortcomings, shortfalls, that you get angry. Right? That is not the embarrassment. It's hardly the embarrassment that. But then to deny that, or even to think that this is the way I am, others have to understand that this is how I am and this is how I come. I'm not going to change. If you want, you change. I was born like this, I shall live like this, and I shall die like this. Live with it. So, when you come across people like that, how do you feel about them? Do you like them? Maybe you like them, but do you like that kind of attitude? You don't like it. Of course not. No one likes that kind of person. But people are very forgiving and understanding of people who have faults, because everyone has faults. I don't think there's a single individual in this, there's not a single soul in this room that's going to put their hand up and say, no, Swami, no, sir, I came perfect. I'm perfect. And I'm here to check that you're perfect. That's why I came here. So, you know, there's not a single human being who believes that they are perfect. So, to accept that another man, another woman, another person has flaws, weaknesses, faults, is very human. It's very acceptable. That's why most times, you know, when someone does something wrong, all they have to say is, I'm sorry. Think about the times when you were on the receiving end of that wrongdoing. Right? The moment they said, I'm sorry, what was your reaction after that? Did you continue to go have a go at them? Did you continue to try and convince them that they were wrong? No. Then your tone changed from an accusatory tone to a very sympathetic tone, didn't it? I'm talking about your own experience. Even if you're trying to tell a child off for something that they have done, the moment they say, Ane, I'm sorry, Amma, what happens then? Then you cool down. Your tone changes, your approach changes. And then after that you stop accusing them. You say, okay, you know, it happens to everyone. See? Now you try to soothe them. You say, it's okay, Putta, you know, it happens to everyone. What's great is the fact that you have accepted that you have done something wrong. What a great characteristic that is. What a great quality that is, that you have, you're willing to accept that, you're so humble to accept that. And we'll work on that together. But no matter who it is, if they hold their stance and they say no, even when they, sometimes they know they're wrong. And you've tried to argue with them. And then if it's come to a point where you've kind of checkmated them, but they're still not prepared to accept that they were wrong because they have such big an ego, that to accept that they have done something wrong is akin to having their heads chopped off. So they will not accept that they are wrong, but they will continue to hold their stance and say very irrationally, no, I was right. And then they start turning the conversation not from the fault to the person accusing. It becomes personal after that. The objective becomes subjective. Who do you think you are? These things start coming after that. Why do you think like that about me? People are very quick to personalize problems. So you've dealt with people like that, so you know what it feels like to work with individuals like that. You have met them at the workplace, right? You have met them amongst friends. You have them at home. They're everywhere. So if you've experienced what it is like to be the individual who has to face off to individuals like that, then my first ask of you is not to be that person. Not to be like that. There's no shame in accepting a fault, a flaw, a weakness. There's absolutely no shame in that. And please understand, ladies and gentlemen, that everyone makes mistakes and everyone understands that mistakes can be made by a human being. People know that. People know that they are not perfect, although sometimes they pretend to be, but they know that they're not. Therefore, don't let your pride get in the way. It's usually that pride that gets in the way of solving a problem that can be solved so easily. That when you let pride get in the way, ego get in the way, then it escalates into something very ugly. You've lived long enough to experience what I'm talking to you about. That these things happen at home mostly, then sometimes even at the workplace. This is very common in your homes. Husbands and wives and, you know, parents, children, siblings, friends. At the workplace sometimes you're a bit careful about what you say, because the ramifications can be quite severe. Therefore you're very careful about what you do. But then at home we take things a lot more for granted, don't we? Because, you know, the people at home, it's okay to hurt them, because they're yours for good. But at the workplace, it's not so. You feel more insecure at the workplace because you don't know what might happen. you have been appointed, you have been employed, you have been given a position there, so the person who gave it to you might take it away from you. Therefore, there's always that insecurity. But at home, not so much. But you forget then that marriage is also a deal. That's a contract. Just like your employment contract. This is called a marriage contract. Usually they're more forgiving. Usually. Sometimes your boss is more tolerating of you than you are. That is also possible. But as Mahatma Gandhi once said, you know, if you want to change the world, start with yourself. Please remember then, that whenever you have these encounters with nature, right, nature is all of you. Nature is all of you and each and every one of you. That is nature. Nature is the clouds that rain on you. It's the sun that shines on you. It's the wind that blows and blows that breeze against you. All of this is nature. It's the man who's going to honk at you on the street. It's the three-wheel driver that's going to just cut in front of you. It's the man who's going to take your parking spot just as you drive into it. It's that person. That's nature. Don't forget that that was an order that you placed. Most of you will have experienced on the roads as you drive here and there. Yeah, people cut in front of you. Sometimes people tailgate you. Right? Other people will drive in front of you. They'll deliberately try and drive slowly just to try and hold you back for some reason. Sometimes you wonder why they're doing that. These are all orders that you'd placed. So never ask why them, ask why me. Not as in, why me, why not the other person? Why did I? If something seems irrational to you, it's because you had done something. Back then it seemed rational to you, but now it seems irrational. This is the foundation to start cultivating the Dhamma. You have to start here. Otherwise we always point our fingers outwards. Always have that compass, a moral check. Try and live in a way that you're always reminded, you know, in a flash of a second you're reminded, this is something that I had given. This is my own doing. Like, sort of keep that at the back of your head, always going, this is something that I had given. This is my own doing. This is my own doing. This is my own doing. You see, when someone wins the lottery, or when someone gets something nice, something they like, something they enjoy, when something good happens to them, then people are like, you know, someone like me of course deserves this. A good person like me, right? Someone who goes to the Sunday sermons every week. Someone as good as me, someone as holy as I. Someone who looks after my parents like I do. Someone who does my job so honestly as I do. Someone who's such a good citizen as myself must of course deserve something like this. You know, I'm so generous, I'm so kind to people. How many hungry people must I have fed? How many beggars must I have given things to? How many poor people must I have looked after? Right? So you very easily you're able to rationalize the good things that happen to you. The reason for that is because at that time your mind is in a state of prasada. It's in a pleasant state. So it's easy to see things as they are. So then you say, of course things like this happen to me because I'm a good person. Good things happen to good people, you will say. But when it switches, when you get the other end of the stick, when bad things happen to you, when the so-called bad things happen to you, there's no such thing called a good thing or a bad thing, but when the things that you don't like happen to you, that's when you say it's a bad thing. When such things happen to you, it's very difficult, is it not, to remind yourself that this is also your own doing? catch yourself when this happens. At least before you go to bed at night, just do a mental check of the things that happened to you that you didn't like on that day. Just take one or two incidents at least and ask yourself, why did that happen to me? See if you can work out that it must have been something you had given, an order that you had placed. Now it's just been served, that's all. So why the Dhamma then? Why do we need the Dhamma? I will come to that in a moment, but this is the foundation. We must start here. Kammasagata Sammaditti. It's very important, ladies and gentlemen, because without an understanding of Kammasagata Sammaditti, there is no need then to understand the Dhamma. To understand the profound truths of the Dhamma almost becomes redundant if you don't accept this Kammasagata Sammaditti. In other words, what comes back to you is what you had given. What you give is what you get. I will explain to you in a moment why this is the foundation to that. But before that, I want to make sure that you are able to see and experience and understand these experiences that come to you in that way. Now, let's do let's think about last week, just last week gone. Think of one or two things that might have happened to you. Think of a good thing that happened to you first. Something good, something you liked, something that put a smile on your face, something that made you feel like life is good. I must be such a good person for things like this to happen to me. Something like that, that must have happened to you. Yeah, you all got something in mind? No? Then take last Sunday then. If nothing good has ever happened to you. And the only good thing that happens to you is Sunday morning. Then let's go back to Sunday morning. If not, take something. Maybe it was your birthday. Maybe someone gave you a gift. Right? Maybe someone gave you some flowers. Maybe someone, you know, smiled at you and said good morning and gave you a hug. Right? And that just, you know, put you on cloud nine. Maybe someone got you a pet. I don't know what makes you happy, but maybe that's what they did. Maybe someone baked a cake for you or made a pudding for you and, you know, said, hey, I was thinking about you and I wanted to make something for you. Here you go. Something. Or maybe the boss asked you to come into the office and then he or she thanked you for a job well done. Maybe it was an email from a client appreciating the good hard work that you had done. Maybe it was something like that. Maybe a friend took you out for a coffee. Maybe a colleague that you'd lost contact with for some time. Maybe, you know, it was a reunion. School friends. Think of something good, something nice that happened to you recently. It made you feel good, made you feel happy, right? I want you to understand that this is again an order that you had placed. All those people who brought it to you, they are the waiters. But they don't cook what they want. They cook what you want. So in this restaurant, you can't go up to the... when the waiter comes up to you, you can't say, surprise me. In some restaurants, you can do that. They come up to you, what do you want, sir? Surprise me. So, in this restaurant, you can't do that. Your order has to be placed explicitly. Only explicit orders are taken. So much so that if you don't place an order, the waiter will keep standing by your side until the end. Until you leave the restaurant, they will stand by your side, waiting for you to place the order. This is what happens once you become an arahant. Until you leave the restaurant, the waiter will keep standing by your side, waiting to take the order. Right? But there'll come a point where ultimately you get up and you leave the restaurant. Until then, the waiter will be there. Only you just don't give new orders, that's all. But the waiter is there, ever ready to take your order. But with the rest of us, we are busy giving out orders. Orders to nature. Can I have this? Can I have that? Can I have a bit of this? Can I have a bit of that? So the waiters are constantly running in and out of the kitchens. It's like, it's frantic. They're just running constantly in and out of the kitchens, always bringing back something that you'd ordered. Maybe you ordered 5 minutes ago, maybe you ordered 15 minutes ago, maybe you ordered 5 days ago, maybe 5 years ago, maybe 5 lifetimes ago. Because some dishes take longer to cook. Others can be made almost instantly. Either way, every order is an order, or every serving is an order that you have placed. I really, really, really want you to acknowledge this and embrace this truth. This will be the stepping stone for further understanding of your Dhamma, of the Dhamma. Because without this, if you don't accept this, ladies and gentlemen, there is hardly much use in actually trying to get into the depths of the Dhamma. Let me quickly explain to you why that is. I will go into more detail in a moment. You see, if you accept that these are all orders that you place to the waiter or with the waiter, you will realize at one point that there are certain orders that you don't want to place. You don't want to place them, but they are placed nonetheless. You feel like you don't want to. You want to stop yourself from doing it, but it comes out of you. It just comes out of you. Have you heard of this condition called tics? Not the tics that you get on your body. It's a condition called tics. I first got to know about it when I was in the UK. Like, randomly people would just come up and swear at you. It's like, what? Why? And usually it's also almost always swear words as well. Now, for whatever reason, I don't know, but it's almost always swear words, which I'm not going to repeat here. So whatever swear words you know, dirty minds that you have, right? Those ones, right? So whatever those swear words are. And there was, so I was quite perplexed as to why, what this condition is all about. So then I watched a documentary at the time, I remember, and I was really surprised that it was actually a real condition. And they can't help themselves and they feel really embarrassed, and then they have to inform everyone, their teachers, sometimes in the classroom it happens, at the workplace it happens, in the family it happens. So unless you understand that this is a condition they have, you know, they get beaten up most of the time until people acknowledge that this is actually a medical, clinical condition. So anyway, there's this condition called tics. So what happens is either verbally or physically, there are certain responses that they have and they cannot help it. It just happens. They are involuntary. So this is what medical science says. So very similar to that is the situation I'm talking about. You don't want to be angry, but you are. You get angry. You don't want to say harsh things to people, but when you tense up enough inside, when it heats up enough inside, when it becomes unbearable, those things just come out of your mouth. Oh, haven't we all been there? Things that have just come out of our mouths, and then you wonder, why did that come out of my mouth? And then you can say sorry 100 times, but then what has been said has been said. I think we've all lived long enough to understand when that happens and the consequences of that. But then if you look at why such situations happen and why you have to face these situations, it is because there's raga, dvesha and moha working inside of you. To put it very simply, ladies and gentlemen, raga, dvesha and moha is your resistance of nature. It is resistance to nature. That is what raga, dvesha, moha are. These are the three ways in which you resist nature. With raga or desire, when nature gives you something, nature has no intention to let you have it, let you keep it for good. It's a very fleeting instance of something. It's here now, it's gone in the next moment. But that is not what you want. You want it for yourself and you want to have it for good. That's when you have raga, desire. So what does nature want to do? Very momentarily show it to you and take it back. Do you remember the flower I had in my hand the other day? Yeah, as when I was turning it at its stem. And you had given me complete control over your happiness. I could show you the blossom part of the flower, and that made you happy. As I turned it the opposite side, it made you unhappy. At least that was the example I was using on the day. So, nature, if nature had been me, in that instance, I'm showing you something, but it's not your agenda, it's my agenda. I decide, I choose for how long I want to show this to you. But when you resist nature, in other words, when you resist nature's agenda and have your own agenda, and then you end up saying, can I have that? Nature says, I'm going to show you something. And you say, can I have that? They say, no, it's not for you to have, it's for you to see. See. You say, have. You say, see, have. This is a problem. Nature never brings anything to you to have, to keep. Can I have it? Nature never expects you to even make that request. Can I have it, please? May I have that? No, nature only says what? See, look at this. Hear this. Smell this. Taste this. Feel this. That's all nature says. All the while you're going, can I have it? This is desire. In very simple language. See, we're breaking the Buddhism down to very simple words, simple language. Anyone can understand. A six-year-old must be able to understand this. This is not complex. The practice of it requires consistency and diligence. That is why most people fail. You need merits to understand this, but from there on you need vigor. You need courage. You need determination. Resolve. That's why most people fail. The lack of consistency. So if anyone else has it on them, just check. We always, look at the positive side of anything, right? Because that is nature. That's nature. Because I only started talking about desire. I'll go into aversion in a moment now. If you resisted that, right, a phone went off. If you resisted that in your mind, then that is you going against nature. Then there are consequences. Remember, that's an order that we had all placed. We all together placed that order. So whose fault is it then, when it is served? You can't fault anyone. That's just an order that has been served. That's it. Someone played the role of the waiter. Maybe in a moment another waiter will serve the next order. Any more waiters in the house today? So you heard that laughter, right? You heard the laughter. Yeah? What was that? Another order. And the cough. So when I clear my throat, you come here to listen to me clearing my throat or listen to the sermon? Huh? You come here to listen to the sermon. So why do you get that as well? These awful sounds I have to make when I clear my throat. Why do you have to listen to that as well? These are all orders that you had placed. So, forever at your service. That's all I can say, forever at your service. What are you to someone else? Forever at their service. Then tell me, ladies, when your husbands are good to you, what are they doing to you? Being at your service. When they're not being good to you, what are they doing now? for being at your service. Yes. Have they ever got an order wrong? Have they ever got an order wrong? No. Any order placed at this table always arrives at this table. That art has been perfected. The universe never gets it wrong. I want you to understand this and acknowledge this truth. Because to go the next step and understand the Dhamma only becomes important and relevant when we base ourselves in this understanding. Otherwise, there's no need to understand it really. So like I said, you know, I was talking about tics and these reactions that we have, either verbally or physically. Just like an individual who has this condition has very little control or hardly any control at all of their outwardly behaviors, there are times when you feel these emotions inside you, anger, resentment, jealousy, greed, lust, and so on, and then you respond to nature. The reason that we have the Dhamma is to free the mind of desire, aversion, and delusion. Because once you can free the mind of desire, aversion, and delusion, then your response changes. So really, if your current responses to nature is, for example, anger, that is like you having tics. I know you don't want to be angry. I know that. There's no doubt about that. I know you don't like to be angry, but you are. And I know that you don't like the things that come out of your mouth when you are angry. I know that. That's why you later regret. That's why you find yourself going up to them and saying, I'm sorry, I don't know why I said something like that. Please, will you forgive me? Because you don't like such things happening to you, or you don't like those responses. But you can't control yourself, you can't hold them back. When it's tensed inside, that is how it comes out of you. It's like the pressure cooker. When there's enough pressure inside, what happens? You hear the whistle. Right? That's not the cooker's fault, is it? That's how it's designed to be. When there's enough pressure inside, the pressure has to be released somehow. And when it does, there's a whistle. So when you blow your whistle, what's happening then? That's the pressure inside. The thing is, when you blow your whistle, people are hurt. And so when they're hurt, what happens then is your pressure pressurizes them. And then they start pressurizing inside. And then what happens after a while? Then they start blowing their whistle. So then when they blow their whistle, and you are not in your right senses to understand that this was the catalyst for that, and now that's the catalyst for this, you don't understand what's going on. You don't realize that this is just kammasagata sammaditti. You don't realize that these are simply orders that are being served. What happens then? You retaliate. So then you can imagine, one whistle goes off, the other one goes, shh, the other one goes, shh. The next one goes, shh. Is that not how things escalate? After a while, they're both blowing, right, at full force. And then, who gets to know? The cat. That's what I say. When your pets at home begin to realize that there's a problem at home, trust me, there's a catastrophe. That is a big problem. The Dhamma is to help you learn that this is what's going on inside you and then turn the cooker off. That is the solution. Because what's pressurizing you inside is the heat that's coming from the stove. Because that's where the fuel is. That's where the fire is. But that's what the Dhamma does. But initially you need to understand that the problem here is that whatever is coming at me is my own doing. A time when you were under fire, a time when you were pressurized, a noise that you had made is now echoing. These are all echoes of noises that you had made once. Like I said, when nature comes up to you, all nature does is this. These are the five things that nature does. Nature says, look at this. That's all. You say, can I have it? Nature says, listen to this. You say, can I have it? Then nature says, smell this. And you say, can I have it? Nature says, taste this. You say, can I have it? And it says, here, touch this, feel this. And you say, can I have it? No, it's not nature's job to respond to your can I have it's. It just comes and shows you whatever it wants to show you and it walks away. Then there are other times where you say, I don't want to look at it. Nature says, look at this. You say, no, I don't want to. But look at it. You say, no, I don't want to. And you can't close your eyes either. It will show it to you somehow. Imagine you didn't have eyelids. You didn't have eyelids and your head was fastened so you couldn't turn your head away from the sight that's in front of you. Imagine things were like that. Okay? Now? Because this was a punishment back in the day. People were not allowed to sleep. So sleep deprivation used to be a punishment. So what they did was, they'd turn your eyelids up and stick it somehow to some part of your head, like to your forehead or something. So otherwise you could close your eyelids and that would help you fall asleep. And then what they do is they shine bright lights at you this is sleep deprivation. It's a very gruesome form of punishment. Because the mind goes crazy when you haven't had enough sleep for a few days. You become delirious. With all the brain chemicals and whatnot. It becomes a toxic concoction inside your brain and the rest of your body. So this used to be a punishment back in the day. Now people do it voluntarily, don't they? When they want to have a good life. When they are not content with what they have. Yes? Oh no. Yes, of course. You know what I'm talking about, right? Yes. Now it's a voluntary punishment. When people want to get higher up in their career, when they want a bigger house, a bigger car, when they want a bigger qualification, when they want to get themselves recognized in society, then they're willing to undergo that as a voluntary punishment. What does biology tell you? You must give yourselves at least 6 or 7 hours of sleep. That is how you were made. Your body needs rest. The mind needs no rest, but the body needs rest. The mind needs no rest because even while you're asleep, the mind's still working. It's not like the mind can stop while you're asleep. The mind still works. But the body needs rest. Really, the only rest for the mind is when the mind is in the Dhamma. That is the rest that the mind needs. Because let's be honest, if all there is one single chitta, and then the next chitta comes, and when the next chitta comes, the previous chitta is not there, and it is not you who's thinking, then who's the one who needs rest? If you don't agree with me, I'll explain to you why I tell you that the mind needs no rest. This is one chitta. You can only have one of these at once, right? Let's assume you're reading a book. Right? So there's one chitta. When that chitta passes away, there's another chitta. When that passes away, there's another one. at each instance, there's only one chitta. So now let's put it on the timeline. This is what's going on. This is on the timeline, don't forget. Meaning, at one instance, there's only one. That's why it's on the timeline. So then, when this chitta arises, who does that chitta belong to? Assume these chittas are going on in this mind or in this body, because the mind needs a body to operate. So assume that these chittas are occurring here. Okay? And his name is Sam. Don't like Sam? Oh, Saman. Okay, now he's Saman. Right? So these chittas are going on in Saman. Then can I ask you a question? Who does this chitta belong to? Saman. Does this chitta belong to Saman? Well, this was the chitta after this one, so surely it belongs to Saman. No? Who does it belong to? There's no such thing called belonging. How does a chitta arise? Hetum paricha sambhuta. That's how a chitta arises. When the eye comes into contact with an object, a chitta is born. This is the eye. When the eye comes into contact with an object, a chitta is born. To whom? To whom is a chitta born? Wrong question. Chitta does not happen to anyone. A chitta happens, that's it. So who is the one that you are? To whom chittas arise? This whom is also a fabrication in the chitta itself. I really need you to grasp this, ladies and gentlemen, because this is your freedom. If you are weary and you are burdened, this is where we can give you rest. This is freedom. You feel mentally exhausted when you think that all of this is happening to Saman. If you are Saman, oh, you don't like Saman, okay, Samanti. So whether Sam or Saman or Samanti, whichever floats your boat, it's when you think that it is your mind that is the reason for mental exhaustion. That's when you say, I've been thinking about this since morning and my head hurts. Have you not experienced mental exhaustion? Some of you agree, others are like just lying, because we've all been there. When you were doing your O-levels, when you're doing your A-levels, when you're doing your scholarship exams in grade 5, or when you're staying up late preparing for that interview, or you had a report that you had to complete and submit before the deadline. Or there you had to prepare for something, for some meeting with a client, or whatever it was. Mental exhaustion we've all experienced. And then typically what they say is, if you think about the same thing for too long, then the result is mental exhaustion. So what do people generally say? Don't think about the same thing for very long. Change your attention from time to time. And then they say meditate. That is offered as a remedy. So, now, you see, when they say meditate, what are you supposed to meditate on? Let's take the conventional meditation techniques that you might have picked up here and from here and there. Focus on your breath. Isn't that focusing on the same thing for a long time? Huh? So, if for relaxation, for mental relaxation, if what you're supposed to do is focus on your breath, and the reason that you had to do it was because you were mentally exhausted, because you've been focusing on the same thing for a long time. Come on, where's the logic there? Come on, people. Because if this is mentally exhausting, then focusing on your breath should be what? Equally mentally exhausting. And let's be honest, it is. It is. That's why if I ask you to sit down now and focus on your breath, how long can you do it before you get tired of it? And it's supposed to be relaxing, it's supposed to be... What's the word? Therapeutic. It's supposed to be therapeutic, right? Cathartic. So then you should be able to just focus on your breath for any period of time, and the longer you focus on your breath, the better it should be. But if we did an experiment now and I asked you to sit down and just focus on your breath and nothing else, you know that you won't be able to last more than 5 minutes. Because your mind will start wandering. And then you will try to bring it back to your breath again. I know, you know. Because I know what you do when you come to the Valley Mandala at the monastery. That is why focusing on the same, on the same object is not the objective of what we are trying to teach you here. That is not the objective. It is not single-mindedness or focusing on the same object, because you, we already know that that is very taxing and very exhausting. We've lived long enough and focused on the same thing enough number of times to learn that for ourselves. It's not that. So then, how does this mental exhaustion occur? Let's look at it. Let's try and understand that. It happens when you think it is you who's been doing it for an X period of time. That's when it becomes exhausting. Now you enjoy watching movies. Maybe not now, because now you are Dharmishta Rajagiriyans. When you used to be Adharmishta Rajagiriyans? Back then, you used to enjoy watching movies, right? But what if the movie, for 3 hours, it was just a screen with just a, you know, one color, that's it. Let's say it was your favorite color. What's your favorite color? That one. So whatever that color is, assume that the screen is just that color. For 3 hours, you just have to keep staring at that. Will you? Would you? Why not? It's your favorite color. Why wouldn't you? For 3 long hours, you can keep staring at your favorite color, surely. Nothing could be better than that. You already know, even without trying it out, that it's going to be severely mentally exhausting, right? That's because, what is the reason for this? Because you are Sam, you are Saman, and you are Samanthi. And when that happens, you think that it is you who's been looking at this for that length of time. Whereas the truth is not that. What is the truth? Each time the eye comes into contact with this object, a chitta is born. Whose chitta is that? To whom did that chitta arise? Saman? No. There is no owner. There is no one there when a chitta arises. You know, it's like when you walk into this room and you say, there was no one here when I arrived. Every chitta says the same thing. Imagine you were the first person to walk into this room. That someone must be here. Someone walked into this room this morning and then there was no one else here. Right? So, whenever that individual walked in, they would have observed that the room was empty and would have said what? If we'd asked them, is anyone in there? They would have said, no, there was no one in there when I walked into the room. Each chitta that arises says that. They don't say it, but that is what they would say if you'd ask them. If you ask them, that's what they would say. Because there is no saman here when the chitta arises. So it's not like this. Let me try and depict it for you to explain to you what it is not. Okay? So, wake up. This is what it is not. Okay? It's not like there's saman here and then chittas arise and pass away on this bed of saman. Like saman or samanti, whoever, he is here, he or she is here, and the chittas arise and pass away on him. That's not how it happens. It's not like this mind exists and in that these chittas arise. Nonsense. There is no Sam here for chittas to arise and pass away. If that were true, then you would have been able to answer the question, whose chittas are these? If that were true, if this was, this existed, persisted. This is what people say, or they think is an Atma. This is what people say is the me, the I. Because you feel that such a thing exists. Now, this morning you had something to eat. Who is it that had that food? What is your answer that comes from within? I. So, last night you had dinner. Who is it that had dinner? Again, I. Don't you feel that there was this one person that's here right now, was also there in the morning, was also there last night, and that one person that persisted, time, the dimension of time, did various things. Isn't that what your experience tells you? Are you all with me? Yes? If that didn't make sense, just give me a show of hands. Okay, there are a few hands. Yesterday, you existed, didn't you? You were there yesterday. I was there, I was at the monastery. You were here. Some of you were at the monastery. But others were somewhere else. You were there. You existed. You were there. Today, you are here. Tomorrow, you will be there. So we have these three tenses that we have to explain what happens to us. The we are here, I am here, and things happen to me. This is our experience. This is our personal experience. So, if I were to draw what your personal experience is, it is something like this. See, this is the day you were born. Okay, let's keep it to this lifetime. Not go back to previous lives. You were born. This is birth. We are somewhere here now. And here someday we will die. Okay. Okay? I have to go on arms round today. Right. So we were born. Now we are alive. And someday we will die. Agreed? Okay, are you ready? So, it seems like this is what's happening to us. We are here now. So it seems like we were born with a lease of life. And we are consuming that lease. And then someday we will have consumed it in its entirety, unless some other accident happens or something unexpected, but we will someday die, right, through natural death or through some other cause. So is this not how it feels, how life feels? It's like a ticker tape, like there's a tape that has a start and an end. So then this whole thing together, the whole thing, the whole entity. Don't we feel, before I get there, while we are alive, things happen to us. So if you go to when you were born, you know, you hardly remember anything from your birth. I mean, you may have the first memories of you when you were a child, I don't know about you, mine are from when I was maybe 7 years ago, 7 years of age. I don't have any memories from before then. Maybe some of you have memories of before then as well. Whatever it is, we know that even before, even further back than our memory stretch, we were there. Because we have seen other children come into this world and how they are born, right, as an infant, and then they grow up, you know, into childhood, adulthood, and so on. So what we know, ladies and gentlemen, is from that moment we were born, things have kept happening. And this is why I draw these things. These are simply events that happen in our lives. So I'll take one or two. You celebrated your first birthday. So that is, that day was full of experiences. Lots and lots and lots of things happened on that day. So although we say the birthday was an event, within that event, how many things happened? Countless things happened. Right? So by things I mean seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling. Each of these things is a thing. So here's a thing. You heard that. So a thing happened. That's an event that happened in your life. Okay? So such things have kept happening. Now, tell me, is this not how we feel life is? This is me. I'm alive. This is I. I am alive. Okay? And while I'm alive, things are going on with my life. That's why you say when good things happen, I say you win the lottery. You say life is good. See, life is good. What's the good part? This is the good thing that happened. To what? Life. Actually, not this. The whole thing is life. Whose life? I. Oh, my life. You say, my life is good. Or, my life is good these days. And then say, you know, a day before that or a few days before that, you had a fight. You had a fight at home, some argument. And then you're feeling miserable. And you're asking yourself, why did I bother? My parents said no. My sister said no. My brother said no. My friend said no. And still, I went ahead with it. Why? You ask yourself, feeling miserable. So if I found you on such a day, that's those weeks you come in here and I can see it in your face, like, you know, those days is like, you have a look on your face like, I wish I wasn't born. So then I know the night before must have been a fight. No, I don't read into you, I'm just saying, okay, I'm just jesting. So, but if I did ask you, how are things, what would you say? My life is not good. You say something terrible is going on these days. See, these days. Something terrible is going on where? In my life. So, is this not your experience? Whether this is right or not, we will look at in a moment. But is this not what experience tells you is actually going on? Right. So there's I. In fact, you feel that this is the I, right? This is my life. Well, this is true if you don't believe in life before and life after. If you deny the existence of a life before this or a life after this, this is true. This is true. But if you accept that there was life before this one and there will be life after this, then this is not true. Then this is true. I mean, they're both wrong, but this is what it feels like. So you'll say, this is my human life. For those in the audience who believe in life after this, you'll say, right now I'm a human life, but I know the kind of life I live, I'll be born a... I was going to say demon, but I'll say deity. I'll be born a deity. The kind of life I live, I'll be born a deity because I'm such a good person. So this I will go from a human life to a divine life, the life of a god or a deity. Whereas if you're not so sure that you're doing the good things, you know, maybe doing a little bit more of the bad things, then you might be really worried after listening to the sermons. Then you're thinking, oh good Lord, now what's going to happen to me? When I die, I'm going to be born an animal or a preta or in one of the four great hells. And now you're really worried about that. So who's going to be born an animal? I am going to be born. So these are the individuals who believe in life after this and life before this. Then there are those individuals who don't believe in that. It's fine, whichever one you believe in, because they're both wrong. So matters not, right? Therefore, so people come and ask me, Swami Nansa, should I believe in life before this, life after this? Then I tell them that the premise in which you ask this very question is flawed. So it really doesn't matter which one you believe in, because they're both wrong. You tell me this number. Okay? Someone says that this is number 6. Another one says that this is number 8. Does it matter which one they believe it is? So two groups of people are trying to argue whether this is 6 or 8. Does it matter what they come to a conclusion? Or what conclusion they come to? Because they're both wrong. So it matters not whether you decide in the end that there is life after this or that there is no life after this. Because in both of these instances, you're talking about a you who has a life after this or a you who doesn't have a life after this. There is no you. Full stop. That's why I hardly spend time in these sermons talking about life after this and life before this. And try and explain to you that there is no one to have a life after this or a life before this, or to not have a life after this, or to not have a life before this. That is what we need to try and understand. Because the truth is, this is neither 6 nor 8. This is 3. Get that? Okay. So then it doesn't matter whether you're this kind of person or whether you're this kind of person, because they're both wrong. Are we good so far? Did that make sense to everyone? Show me if you didn't. If it didn't make sense. Okay. Maybe I will carry on to explain what is it that makes sense, and then you realize that what didn't make sense didn't make sense anyway, so it didn't matter. I'll give you an analogy that might be easy to understand. Assume this is a train. Assume this is a train. Passengers get on and out. They get on and off the train. Okay? If you think that you are the train, your life is the train, or you are the train, and the events that happen are like the passengers getting on and off the train. Okay? That is how people think. Most people think that is what their lives are like. I'm a train, passengers get in and off. But that analogy doesn't work, because that is not the truth. I've just brought in an analogy to explain to you something that is a lie. So there's no point in us furthering that analogy. Actually, I'm going to shift that analogy ever so slightly, then it will make sense to you, because the truth is this. These people themselves, they hold hands. They are the train. Remember as kids, we used to like pretend that we are a train, and each child that joins the train becomes a car or a carriage in the train. And you go around the house, go around the class, right? Pretending that we are a train. That's what's really going on. It's not that there's a train onto which passengers get on and off. These events themselves are the train. But why then, if that is the case, we still feel that there's an I here who goes through these experiences. Because we need an answer to this problem. Once again, if what's really going on are simply these events, and this is the big fat lie, no such thing is happening, but why do we still feel like that? The simple answer to that, it's not simple, but it is understandable. The answer to that is this, ladies and gentlemen. In each of these chittas, there's a process that works. And this process fabricates this experience. Which experience? This experience. Then, let me show you now with this picture what's really going on. Okay? There are chittas. Each chitta is Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara and Vinyana. Each one of these, okay? This is another Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vinyana. This is another Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vinyana. How do they arise? One example is when an eye comes into contact with an object. Another would be when the ear comes into contact with actually sound or vibration. Right? Another would be, let's keep it simple, sound. Okay. So another would be when the tongue comes to contact with taste. So in each of these instances, a chitta is born. And this is the process that allows you or helps you, that enables you to recognize what just happened. So I said, when the eye comes into contact with an object, that is an event. This is the event management team. This event management team, they manage that event. They make meaning of that event. They put sense into that event to the point where that event becomes your perception. Because this is an event, but that's not a perception. To translate that event to a perception is what happens in this process. We call that process, one name for that process, in one word, is chitta. That's why it's called a chitta. Arammana, Vijanana, Lakkhana, Chitta. In English, it would be the characteristic, okay, the characteristic of perceiving an object is a chitta. So that is how the Buddha puts it. It's a characteristic. It's the quality. It's the, if you want, process. The process of perceiving an event, an object, is a chitta. Are we good so far? Right. So, each of these is a chitta. But this is not the end of the story. Unfortunately, beyond the eye coming into contact with the object, beyond this, there's another thing that's going on. We call that the defiling process. This is a vipaka process. So you see, this is all a vipaka process. But then there's something called the defiling process. In other words, you can call it the karma process. They're both the same. Matters not which word you use. This is how karma is generated. Okay? We call it the defiling process. So what is the defiling process? Out of ignorance. Out of ignorance springs attachment. Because of attachment comes vexation. So now we are going to back to the pressure cooker. When you turn the fire on, what happens inside? There's pressure that builds up inside. So that is that vexation that happens in the mind. Each of these minds start to vex. Who starts to vex? I start to vex or you start to vex? No. There's no I or you to vex here. So far, only one thing has happened. The I has come into contact with the object and a chitta is born. That's it. That's all that's happened so far. But it has happened on a bed of ignorance. When I say a bed of, don't think that it's like a bed. What I really mean to say is, this chitta itself is laden with ignorance. It is tainted with ignorance. Ignorance is simply bad knowledge. So with that bad knowledge, it is born. When it is born with bad knowledge, this bad knowledge tells the chitta, or it's not like a conversation, but this bad knowledge is such that there has to be an individual to whom these experiences occur. That is the bad knowledge. This is the knowledge that you have right now. You feel like these things happen to you, don't you? Right? So this all starts with the bad knowledge. We call it avidya. It's bad knowledge. Misinformation. So it all started with that. Because of attachment, it became a vexation. Now, why did it become a vexation? How did bad knowledge go to become vexation or lead to vexation? Well, it's because of this. Now, assume I told you that unless you had some kind of headwear or a cap or a hat on you, and you put it on your head in the next 2 minutes, you're all going to go bald. Just assume it's going to rain, and it's going to be some kind of toxic rain, and then if that water gets on your head, you're going to go bald. Now you'll be looking around to see if you can find something to put on your heads, a cap or a hat or some kind of head cover. But let's assume you didn't have anything like that. What would you start to feel? Tensed up. You start to vex. So you know the feeling of vexation because we go through it every day. The feeling of vexation, right? The same thing happens in the chitta. It's not the same thing. That is that's where it is happening. It's not like what happens to you is always also happening at the chitta. That is where it's happening because you are the chitta, right? So vexation now starts to happen here. For what? To experience what this bad knowledge tells it. What is the bad knowledge again? That there is an individual to whom this is happening. But is there such an individual? There is no such individual. And this is the reason there's a vexation. Because on the one hand, it says there has to be someone. On the other hand, there is no one. Therefore, now you have an absence. Now I'm going to quickly take you back a couple of weeks. Remember where there's a deficiency? We talked about a deficiency. But deficiencies are always a lead on from a necessity. Yeah? So where there's a necessity that has come out of attachment because of bad knowledge. See, bad knowledge tells you that there has to be an individual. There comes attachment. Now there's a necessity for an individual. But is there an individual? No, because where's the individual here? It's just an incident, an eye coming into contact with an object. No individual there. A chitta is born. No individual there. Am I going too fast? I can slow down. Am I? Okay. So there's no individual here. Right? I'll go through this again because I want you all to walk away with this understanding. I'll go through this again. But this is the first round. So, bad knowledge tells you what? There has to be an individual who experiences this thing, this process. But is there an individual here? No. Why is there no individual here? Why do you say there's no individual? Because there's no reason for there to be an individual, is there? Because what's just happened? Simply a sense came into contact with an object. Is there an individual in the sense? Faculty? Is there an individual in the object? No. Then when the two of them come together, can there be an individual? Excuse me. So there is no individual on either side. No individual in the ingredients. Therefore, when the ingredients come together, there cannot be an individual in the end product. Okay? Right. But what does ignorance say? There has to be an experiencer. Where is the experiencer to whom this is happening? So this question comes up. So now the chitta is wondering, where's the experience? There's no experience. But ignorance says, where's the experience? Where's the experience? Chitta says, no, there's no experience. What? No experience? Says ignorance. Now the chitta starts to vex. And that vexation gets so intense, like the pressure cooker, that this vexation leads to a fabrication, because there's intense vexation in the mind, and then in the mind itself, to satisfy this vexation, the mind conjures up. It's like an apparition, it's like a ghost. That's why it's called a delusion, ladies and gentlemen. It's called a delusion. Out of delusion, actually, this is an illusion. The deluded mind creates an illusion. So out of this deluded situation, there's an illusion of a self. So where was that born then? Where did this sense of self come into existence? In the chitta itself. So really, what happens then is, instead of one long me or I, what's going on is, each chitta this is what's really going on. Here's what's going on. Once again, this is not a lot of cells. Okay? So, I didn't just replace one self with many cells. That's not what I just did. Although it looks like that's what I've just done. This is not like a loaf of bread that I've just sliced up. Okay? So, at first there was one and now there's many. That's not what I've just done. What I'm trying to explain to you is, there is no self at all. The self is only a sense. It's a perception. A perception that is created, fabricated in the chitta that was born to simply process an event. But each chitta, in the process of its life, does this and this. Each chitta now does two things. One, it does what it was meant to do, what it was supposed to do, which is to perceive the object, but it is also laden with ignorance. It's contaminated. Therefore, what happens? Out of ignorance comes attachment, then comes vexation, and out of that vexation comes what we call abhisankara, which is the fabrication process, and out of that comes bhava and comes jati. So now you will recall the paticca-samuppada process. Jati is not a self. Jati is what has happened in the mind, which is the perception of an experiencer of this experience. And then this is why, when you see something, you also think that it is you who's seeing it. So when I show this to you, you don't simply see. You see, and then your mind creates a seer, the individual that sees. Both these things happen in the mind. So there's not one individual. This is not one individual. These are all individual, the wrong word, separate instances. I'm drawing, I'm shading them in different colors just so that you can see that they are different ones. These are all individual experiences of a sense of self. Now, why do I say this is a sense of self and not self? Why? Just because I like to hear the sound of my own voice. Say another word. Right, so we are trying to make the distinction between self and sense of self. Are we good? Now what's the problem? You okay? Okay. So we're trying to make the distinction between a self and a sense of self. Okay? This is, I really want you to pay attention here. This is easy to understand if you have the merits and you pay attention. It's difficult to understand if you don't have the merits and you don't pay attention. I think you have both. Prove me wrong. Here's what I would refer to as a self. Once again, I have to emphasize at this point that such a thing does not exist. This is an imaginary thing. This is fiction. This is fact. Okay? This is a completely fictitious, fictional, fake, all the other F words. This is not a real thing. This is not a real thing. But I'm depicting it for you, showing, drawing it on the board for you to give you an idea of what it would be if it were real. But it's not. Okay? If the self actually did exist, it would have a past. It would have a present. It would have a future. Don't you? Just a simple question. Don't you? Who had breakfast this morning? When did having breakfast happen? In the past. When is dinner going to happen? In the future. When are you listening to the sermon? In the present. What has a past, future and a present? No, nothing. Nothing has a past, future and a present. I just told you, this is not a real thing. This is not a real thing. But isn't this what you feel life is like? But this is a ghost. Just like a ghost. This is a result of ignorance. This is not what's really going on, although it feels like this is what's going on. That's the thing, that's the point I'm trying to make. You know, it's like sometimes when you feel like there's something stuck in your shoe. You feel like something's gotten in your shoe, and then you stop. Right? You walk and you remove your shoe, you turn it upside down, and you see there's nothing in there. You put it back on, and you start walking again. Sometimes you still feel it, other times you don't. And you say, I could have sworn that I felt something there, but there's nothing. This is like that. So, once again, and I'll say this 100 times, save me from saying it 100 times, because I'll say it once, you think about it 100 times. Does this exist? Is there such a thing called self? No, but is this not the experience that you have? Then we are at a dilemma. How is it that something that does not exist gives us the experience that it would if it had existed? How is that possible? That's like saying there's no cat in the room, but you hear a meow. No, seriously, if you heard a meow in the room, what would be your instinct? You'd walk around trying to find the cat in the room. Right? And if you couldn't find one, what conclusion would you have to come to? Either a ghost or that there was someone in the room that was meowing. Yeah? Either your imagination. But anyway, 100 of us can't be wrong. Right? Let's say, assuming all of us can't be wrong. So if we all heard that, like if I asked, did you all hear that meow? And everyone goes, yes, I heard that Swami answer. Then we will all go around trying to see, look in the cupboards, under the desks, under the chairs, whether we can find a cat. But if no cat can be found, then we might have to find who's pretending to be a cat. No cat. But you hear the meow. That's because someone else is pretending to be a cat. But our ignorance, until you discover and then come to wisdom, that he wasn't a cat after all, he was just another person in the room that was just playing a trick. Until you discover that, you really think that there's a cat in the room. The same thing's going on here. This is the meow that you hear. The past, the future, and the present. The experience of existing. Don't you all feel that? The experience of existing, that's the meow. But there's no cat. It's a catastrophic problem. So then if you still hear the meow, but there's no cat, what could it be? Someone else that is actually there, right? Someone else that's actually there, that's not a cat, but pretending to be a cat. So if then this is not there, the cat's not there, in other words, the self is not there, then there must be someone else that's pretending to be the self. And this is what the Buddha discovered. He said, there's no Atma, but there's Jati. There's no Atma. There's no self. There's no I that persists time. Timeless I, a timeless self, a timeless me, there's no such thing. There's nothing about you that has no beginning and that has no end. Because you are not an Atma. You're not a self, you're not an I. But you still hear the meow. Meaning, you still feel all these characteristic qualities of a self had one been there. Now, where does all that come from? This is what the Buddha went looking for. And then he discovered that this is what's really going on. Once again, let's recap what's really going on. Now pay close attention. Let's look at what's really going on. So I've just told you what's not going on, but what seems like is going on. Okay? So you have the symptoms, but it's a different disease. The symptoms are there, but not what you think the problem is. Then here's what the problem actually is. The five sense doors, there's a sixth one, but let's keep it simple. What are the five sense doors? Eyes, ears, nose, tongue. So the five sense doors, they come into contact with the sense objects, indeed. The five sense objects. What are the five sense objects? For simplicity's sake, sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch. So these are corresponding doors and objects. When a door and an object collide or contact is a better word. When they contact, let's just put it this way. There's a response in the universe. The universe responds. When what happens? When a door contacts with an object, the universe responds. What is the universal response? What's the name for it? Chitta. Well done. That is the word for it. Chitta. So you see, now I want you to take a very objective view at what a chitta is. It's not you. So stop thinking now from here on that you are chitta. You are not chitta. It's not your chitta. Chitta is not you. You are not chitta. You are not in the chitta. Chitta is not in you. You are not on the chitta. Chitta is not on you. No. This has nothing to do with you. Do you recall one day I said that you are useless? Now you see how it all makes sense? You are useless because you do nothing. I'm the one who's doing everything. A chitta is merely the universal response to what, ladies and gentlemen? A door come into contact with an object. Give me an example. Eye comes to contact with sight. So when these two, when this happens, this is called an event. This is an event. Right? At this event, there's a universal response. And that response is called the chitta. That's why the chitta, the Buddha describes as arammana vijanana lakkhanam chittam. And arammana is the object. That's why they call it rupa-arammana, saddha-arammana, gandha-arammana, saddha-arammana, pottabba-arammana. These are objects. Sight object, sound object, smell object, taste object, touch object. These are called arammana. So see, arammana, vijanana. Vijanana is perception, perceiving. In other words, making sense of. So if someone asks you, what is vijanana? To make sense of. To perceive, to make sense of. So when there's an object, now it has to be made sense of. Okay? So an object qualifies to be an object when it comes to contact with a door. See, we don't open this door unless someone knocks on the door. I mean, there are people walking past the corridors, right? But we don't open the door just randomly. But if someone came up to the door and knocked on it, what would we do? We open the door and we welcome them. We perceive them. We process them. We acknowledge them. That's exactly what you are doing. Not what you are doing. That's what's happening. You call it you. But it's not you. It's just a natural process. This is the natural response to an object contacting or coming into contact with a door. See, I'm bringing in various analogies to help you understand this concept. But there are plenty of people walking up and down the corridor. Do we open the door? No. Why don't we open the door? Because contact has to happen first. Right? So, but the moment they do? We open the door and we welcome them. So this is where Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana come in. These words I have explained to you previously. I'm not going to go into the depths of it now. We'll talk about it another day. But it's together, collectively, what they do is they process the guest. Right? Okay. Then, that is what a chitta is. So I have drawn here chittas. Each of these is a chitta. But there's a twist to this plot. Although this is what a chitta is supposed to do, unfortunately, this happens with ignorance. Now, ignorance is something a chitta can be in. It's a state. It's a state of mind, a state of chitta. So ignorance is either one or a zero. You're either ignorant or you're not. So it's a state that a chitta can be in. So if it's in a state of ignorance, meaning it has no understanding about what's going on. What is this what that is going on? What is the what that is going on? This process, we are now welcoming the guest. We are acknowledging, receiving the guest, right? So if it doesn't know that what it's actually doing is receiving a guest, if it doesn't know that that is what it's actually doing, now it lives in some kind of fictional fantasy world. And the rules of that world, the principles of that world are governed by the knowledge that the chitta has. Is this making sense? I hope it is. Give me a nod if it is. Give me a nod this way if it's not. Again, give me a nod this way if it's not making sense. Okay. There are one or two nods this way. That's okay. That's okay. The majority of you have begun to grasp this. But it will make sense to everyone, I promise. What are the two things that are required? Merit and paying attention. So, what is the process again? With the analogy, receiving a guest. Who's the guest in this analogy? Who's the guest? This one or this one? Which one's the guest? The object is the guest. And what's the dough? The sense dough. Right? So unless the object comes into contact with the dough, nothing happens. There's no event, therefore no need to process it. We don't process an event that hasn't happened. But the moment there's a knock, now we know that there's a guest at the door. So what do? We open the door and we welcome them in. This welcoming in, acknowledging them, receiving, you could call it the hospitality. This is the hospitality that this guest receives the moment they walk in through that door. That's why I call this event management team. They manage that event. The start is the object, the end is perception. Okay? Right. But this process happens in the presence of ignorance. Now I want you to be clear on what I mean by ignorance. So ignorance is not some other kind of entity somewhere. Ignorance is merely the state that this chitta is in. So although this chitta is here to serve a purpose, it can be in a certain state, can't it? I'll take another analogy to help you understand this. Your car. The purpose of having a car is what? To transport, to travel. But the car can be in two states. It's either empty or it's got fuel in the tank. Or you could say it's either working or it's broken. These are two states that a car could be in. Either way, it's supposed to serve a purpose. And the purpose is what? Whoever gets into the car, you take them places. You don't generally take people who don't get into the car, you don't take them. That's called an accident. If you try to take people who don't get into the car, that's called an accident. Best avoided. But someone who gets into the car, you got to take them from A to B safely. But you can only do that if the car is working, if it's operational, if it's functional, right? So you see, it can be in two states. Now, I'd much rather the state of there not being fuel in the car, because the car, put it this way. Let's take a car that's got. Let's take a car that's not got good springs. Its shock absorbers are really worn out. So now you're going to have a very bumpy ride. It's not going to be comfortable. Yeah, it's going to be a very rough ride. Now, so it's not been serviced. The springs have not been changed, or the suspension has not been fixed. There's a problem with it, and therefore it's a very bumpy ride. It can still take passengers from A to B. But what are the passengers going to experience? A very difficult ride. It's not going to be comfortable at all. Yeah? So it's a state that the car can be in, right? Either a comfortable ride or an uncomfortable ride. When does it become an uncomfortable ride? When the suspension doesn't work properly. When is it a comfortable ride? When the suspension works properly. Now, so this is the analogy. So let's put it back to this situation, this problem here. The chitta is here to serve a purpose, just like the car. It can carry passengers with or without, so the car can carry passengers with or without good suspension. The difference is, if it's got good suspension, then the ride will be comfortable. If it hasn't got good suspension, the ride will be uncomfortable. Likewise, ladies and gentlemen, these chittas will do this process with or without ignorance. With or without ignorance, it will still serve this purpose. But But what? If it has ignorance, then it's not going to be comfortable. It's going to be a very uncomfortable experience. But if it has no ignorance, meaning the suspension works properly, then it's going to be a very comfortable ride. Do you understand that it's a state? This is a state. It can be in one or the other. Okay? So it's not some other separate thing. Ignorance is not some other separate piece that you fit to the car or anything like that. Or to the chitta. It's just a state that the chitta is in. So what is ignorance then? What is ignorance? Ignorance is ignorance of this process. Forgive me for having to define a word with it in the definition. That's the worst way to define something. When you're saying red is red. So ignorance is ignorance of... Actually, ignorance is ignorance of ignorance. I think once I explained it to you, but that is what ignorance is. What is wisdom then? Wisdom is knowledge of ignorance. So ignorance is ignorance of ignorance. Right, come back. So ignorance is bad knowledge. When the chitta is misinformed, when it thinks wrongly, when it does not understand that this is what's going on here, that this is merely an object coming into contact with a door, because what ignorance has in it, this is the script in ignorance, this is what ignorance entails. Ignorance entails that there is an individual who experiences this situation, this experience. Actually, you know, to go back to that analogy of walking through the door and opening the door, assume that it was self-service, like these doors in the servants. Now, when you knock on this door, you don't knock, do you? You don't have manners like that, do you? So, what do we do when you walk into the room? You just open the door, and if the sermon is in progress, typically you'll use the doors at the back, right? So you just open it without making too much of a fuss. You'll come and take a seat, right? So that happens automatically. There's no one there to open the door and walk you in and usher you to a seat. There's no one there to do that for you. It is self-service. That you get very well, don't you? Now imagine if you thought that there has to be someone who has to walk you to a seat. What would you do when you... So today's your first day. You are stood by the door. You open the door, or you are stood outside. You are waiting for someone to come and open it and usher you to a seat. You'd be standing there till the end of the sermon, won't you? Because you are now expecting someone to come and welcome you, hold you by your hand or whatever, and walk you to a seat. Because you think there is someone here who is doing it for me. There's someone here to serve me. So that would be a very uncomfortable experience. But you know that that is not how we do things here. If you walk in, so if you arrive at the door, you just open the door, quietly come in and take a seat. There's no doer. There's no usherer. You just usher yourself in. What's happening here? What is the rupa doing? It's ushering. What is this object doing? It's ushering itself in. The object ushers itself in through the door. So when it comes and stands by the door, you don't need someone to open the door and usher them in. So there doesn't need to be someone there who rupas them and vedanas them and sanyas them and sankaras them and vinyanas them. It happens because it's a natural process. When something's a natural process, who must be there to do it? Who reigns? Who shines? No one. Who blows? No one. Who grows? No one, right? Because then you say these are natural processes. Well, then what can you tell me about the process that is there to perceive the object as it comes into contact with the dough? That's a natural process. Meaning, there doesn't need to be anyone there to usher them in. It's a self-ushering process. Now, when I say self, please don't think I'm talking about this self. Okay? That's not this self, because that would defeat the purpose of me bringing this example, because I'm trying to say that there is no self, and then I'm saying it's a self-ushering process. What I mean to say is, as the rupa comes into, or as the object comes in contact with the door, there doesn't need to be an individual there who holds the object's hand and opens the door and walks them in and then rupas them and vedanas them and sanyas them and sankaras them and vinyanas them. It's not a fixation that someone has to do to you. It happens because it's a natural process. Make sense, everyone? Please. Please make sense. Thank you. Right, so whilst that's going on, that is what is actually going on. But what does ignorance say? What is the script in ignorance? What does ignorance entail? Someone has to usher. So as the ushering happens, but it's self-ushered, not this self, by itself, ushered, ignorance tells the chitta, someone's opened the door, someone's walked them in, someone's taken them to a seat, and someone sat them down. Now bring that analogy back here. Someone's rupered them, received them. Someone's, what is it? Vedana? Registered them. Someone's recognized them. Someone's formed the chitta, or kind of, let's say, there's a doing part here, but no doer, right? There's the processing them, and then someone's finally perceived them. So ignorance puts names against the actions. It personifies a natural process. It says these things cannot happen on its own. There has to be someone who does them. So it starts putting a name against them. So to put the name, it asks a question. Whose name should I put next to this? So ignorance, the script in the ignorance, this is the bug in the software. To draw an analogy from software programming, this is a bug in the code. So the program here comes against this bit of code, and the code says there has to be someone who does this. Now there's a problem. Now the program cannot proceed. I'm mixing my analogies here. Forgive me. Right. Let's come back to the person walking through the door. So we are now with the ignorance says, the script says there has to be someone who walks them into the room. But there's no one to walk them into the room because there is no need for someone to be there to walk them into the room because it's a natural process. A someone would be redundant. A someone would be obsolete. There's no necessity for a someone to be there. If there is no necessity, what happens? There is no deficiency. Yeah? Wherever there is no necessity, there is no deficiency. Wherever there is no deficiency, there is no what? Sufficiency. Created by causes coming together. Yeah? We've spoken about this before this. So what is the process start to end? First, there's a need or attachment. Then comes necessity for that. Then there's the deficiency for it. And then causes align, energy aggregates to create sufficiency, which is the response to that deficiency. I hope today is not your first day. For your sake and mine. Because I'm bringing in lots of things we've spoken about over the past many, many, many weeks and months. Right? I hope you have brought your ingredients with you, because we are just cooking a big broth here. I mean, it'll taste delicious, provided you have all the ingredients with you and you add them to the right quantities. Now, this is why it's important to be regular. Otherwise, this is not a Jataka story, right? Where I can just give you the next Jataka story and it doesn't matter whether you listen to the last one or not. This is the story of your life. So as I give you these dimensions and I explain to you what's really going on there, each step is building up on the one before that. Do your master's and show me without your undergrad degree. Is that possible? No, just like that. You can't do your master's without your undergrad. You can't do your PhD without you doing your master's. Likewise, you can't understand this if you haven't listened to the previous talks. And if you think that's my fault, then I apologize. But don't despair. That's why time to time I'll keep going back and quickly, you know, doing a recap on some of the previous concepts we discussed. But I do encourage you, particularly if you're new, first time, second time, please go back and find the time, because that is not something I can give you. I'm sorry, I know you're busy, but you're going to have to find the time to revisit those concepts. Find the time to watch those sermons. Okay? Otherwise, come to the monastery where our Swami Nuances will sit down with you and you tell them what part of the sermon you didn't understand. Anagarika Mahatmis will do the same for you. They'll sit down and you say, Swami Nuances today came to the sermon, he talked a lot of gibberish. I couldn't make head nor tail of it. He was talking about some person coming to the room. I looked around, no one was coming to the room. Right? And then he was talking about some cat. I don't even have a cat. And we looked around, there was no meow in the room anyway. I was so utterly confused, I don't know what Swami Nuances is talking about. So you take that to the Swami Nuances at the monastery, who will sit down with you and work you through and try and explain to you the basics so that things start to make sense. Right? But this is a mass sermon, right? This is a mass class. So I cannot go into individual bits where you don't understand and fix all of it. Let's do a general, do the best we can. Okay? So, what is ignorance again? The story of what's going on here, that is ignorance. Because the mind is now ignorant, given that it has now taken on the bug's there. Okay? The bug of ignorance is there. Therefore, the mind now looks for a doer. Because the script of ignorance asks the question, who is it that's perceiving? Who is it that's receiving? Who is it that's registering? Who is it that's forming? So now these questions need an answer. Because there's no answer to give, the mind starts to vex. And then this vexation becomes so intense that out of vexation, springs a remedy, a solution to this vexation. Now, I was talking about the connecting the dots between, what was it? Necessity, deficiency, aggregation to provide sufficiency. Right? So, where there is no deficiency, there is no need for a sufficiency, there is no need for aggregation. But when the question is asked, who is it who's doing this? Who is it that's doing this? Now there's a deficiency. Now there's a deficiency. When there's a deficiency, there has to be aggregation to do what? To create sufficiency. So now what happens? Now the chitta has to work hard to create sufficiency, because there's a deficiency where there's a question that goes, who is it that's doing it? Who is it that's doing it? Who is it that's doing it? There's no rest to the chitta until this question is answered. That's why I said, it is not a long one of these. Right? It's not one long one of these. It's many of these. Because each chitta has to individually fabricate an answer to that question. Yes. It has to individually fabricate an answer to that question. Who is it that's doing this? And so the chitta, out of ignorance, out of vexation, almost warps itself and creates a sense of self. Because remember, ladies and gentlemen, chittas can't create anything other than perceptions. Because what is a chitta after all? It's the perceiving process, right? So a chitta cannot really create a self. All it can create are perceptions. So anything it spews out is a what? It has to be a perception. So then even if it were a self, it cannot be an actual self, can it? It can only be a mere perception of a self. That's why we call it a sense of self. So then what happens? The chitta, where such a thing did not exist, I'm talking about this chitta now, rupa vedana sanya sankhara vijnana happens, but ignorance is there, asking this question relentlessly, who is it that's doing this? There's no answer to give, so it goes into a state of vexation, intense vexation, and as a result of that, fabricates an answer to this question, it's the self. But alas, when it is perceived, so now it creates this. This is a creation. Is it self or sense of self? Sense of self. When this sense of self is fabricated, it has every characteristic. Every characteristic of a self had one existed in reality. But it is not a self. It has every characteristic, every bit of it. All the qualities of a self, had one existed, it has that. So what are some of the characteristics? A past, a present, a future. So this sense of self now, is this a rupa vedana sanya sankhara vijnana process? Is it? No, that's a separate one. Because that is not based in ignorance. This is the part that's based in ignorance, right? So this sense of self that is created here now has the characteristics of a self, but it is not a self. So can it not meow? Can't it meow? It can. But is it a cat? No, it's not. So not all things that meow are cats. All cats meow, but the converse is not true. Not all things that meow are cats. So all selves would have a past, present and future. But the thing is, there is no such thing called a self. But then here we have the perception of a self. We call it the sense of self, and it has the characteristics of a past, present and future. Now, finally, let me explain to you, why then, if this is what's going on, why you feel this and you don't feel this? Because if this is what's really going on, then why don't you feel this? Right? Why don't you feel like each chitta is producing a sense of self? Why don't you feel that? Like why don't you feel in every chitta, I'm a new me now. And now I'm a new me. Why don't you feel that? Why do you feel like you are this one me that existed from the beginning of time till the end? And the reason is this. Whenever the ingredients are the same and the recipe is the same, the dish is the same. Okay? See, up here, these ingredients constantly change, don't they? Those ingredients constantly change. Because at one point it's the sense eye dough. Next time it's the sound, it's the ear dough. Another time it's the tongue dough. Another time it's the nose dough. Another time it's the touch dough. These are the five sense faculties. So the doughs keep changing. What about the objects? There are an infinite variations of the object. Because after all, what are objects? These are differences in energies. So how many different combinations of energy can we have? An infinite number. Therefore, infinite combinations of energy coming into contact with five sense doors. How many combinations can you get out of it? An infinite number of combinations. Yeah? Therefore, these experiences will seem different to you. See, you never think that hearing is the same as seeing, do you? You do never feel like that. Hearing is the same as seeing, or that seeing is the same as tasting. No, I mean, if that were true, then you would just look at a papadam and be happy with it. But you don't, because once you see it, what else must you do? Take it close to your mouth then, smell it. The fried oil, you know, that smells nice. And then that's not enough either. What must you do then? Put it into your mouth and go crunch, crunch. You must hear it as well. And then taste it as well. And then feel the sensation of the papadam crackling inside your mouth. Five in one. That's your papadam. Utterly useless food, isn't it? Of course. It gives you has no nutritional value. I mean, barely anything. And if you ate all that, if that is all you ate, then you'd be walking to the grave. But it gives you all five in one. But why do you need all five? It's because each combination the mind picks up as a different experience. Why is it that the mind picks up? How is it that the mind picks them up as different experiences? Once again, how is it that the mind picks them up as different experiences? Because they're all different combinations of energy. The smell of a papadam is a different condensation of energy to the taste of a papadam, which is a different combination of energy to the sight of a papadam. So then these are all different combinations of energies. Although you only have the five sense doors, there's an infinite number of energy levels that come into contact with these sense doors. Therefore, they trigger, as a result of that, an infinite number of sensory experiences. But, what is it that creates a sense of self? The same script. Nitya Sukha Atta tells you what? There has to be an experiencer. Big or small? No. Experiencer. No size to it. Male or female? No. Just an experiencer. Those, the sizes, the genders, all of them come later. We are talking about the core experiencer. At its core, the doer. The doer can come various shapes, various sizes, various ages. That doesn't matter. Various ethnicities, all that can change. But I'm talking about the experiencer. It's like, what's the only common thing about all of us? We're all human. Are you more human than someone else in this room? What is the degree of your humanity? Or your humanness? We're all equally human, aren't we? But then beyond that, now start the differences. There are the gender differences. There are the age differences. There are the complexion differences. Right? Then there are the characteristical differences. There are the temperamental differences. Get that? But at the most basic primitive level, we're all the same. Likewise, the necessity for there to be an experiencer is always the same. I choose my words very carefully because I want you to pay attention and place these words into the knowledge that you already have so that you can then start joining the dots. So I want to see those light bulbs going off. The necessity. Why am I talking about necessity again? Without necessity, there is no deficiency. Without deficiency, there is no aggregation for a sufficiency. Yeah? If you take the script of ignorance, at its most basic level, what it says is, there is an experiencer. There is an usherer. There is a doer. big or small? No. I don't care. There is a doer. There is an usherer. Tall, handsome? No, don't care. There has to be an usherer. That is the necessity I'm talking about. At its very core, this necessity for an individual. The necessity for an individual. And ladies and gentlemen, because that necessity is the same, it's identical in every script that applies to each chitta. Here, and here. Because it's the same that applies to each chitta. Then if the necessity is the same, the deficiency is the same. If the deficiency is the same, the aggregation to satisfy the deficiency is also the same. Therefore, the moment that aggregation happens, you take that into your hand and you will not be able to tell one aggregation apart from another. Because those aggregations are entirely identical. They're identical. Therefore, in each chitta, although it's fabricated individually in each chitta, the script is the same. But one could be seeing, another could be hearing, another could be smelling, another could be tasting. But the doer, that's the same. That's the same across each chitta. Therefore, the way that each chitta experiences the doer, is that different or similar? Actually, it's not similar, it's the same. It experiences the same thing, the same experience. The same experience. Now then, if you experience this here, 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 if the experience is the same, now how can you tell them apart? If two things are identical, how can you tell them apart? I mean, when you have to tell two things apart, what do you use? Differences, of course. To tell two things apart, you need differences. Do you see the irony here? What is the self trying to do? What is the self trying to do? Exactly. The self is trying to differentiate you from another. Right? But the very thing that it's trying to do, it conceals itself from. Whatever it's trying to do, what is the self trying to do? It's telling you that you are different to the person next to you. Isn't it? That's why we all feel that we are separate individuals. But in each chitta, it's doing the same thing. But it's doing it so masterfully that it conceals what it's trying to do. It stops it from being identified as a separate sense of self to the one next to it. I don't know whether you are nodding because you are being polite or whether you are nodding because you just understood what I just tried to explain to you. Why do we need this sense of self? What does ignorance tell you? That we are all different to one another, right? And is it not because that works in our hearts, in our minds, that we all feel that we are so different to one another, right? See, if the whole point of the sense of self is to give us this sense or this sense of identity that we are so unique and separate to one another, then the very place where it's working, where it's operating, we should feel that, mustn't we? But do you see how skillfully it conceals itself? It covers its tracks. It doesn't allow its dirty work to be seen to the outside. Is this one self or lots and lots and lots of senses of self? It's just lots and lots and lots of senses of self, but they are so covert in the way they operate that you cannot tell one sense of self apart from the next one. Leaving you in the feeling that you are just one of these. But the whole point of this is to separate you out from the rest of them. But where it's working, you can't separate it out from the rest of them. I mean, if this is not a master creation, I don't know what is. So elaborately, so beautifully, so masterfully. I mean, this is a work of art, I have to say. No wonder it takes a Buddha to crack the code. It is so eloquently, so elegantly done that to crack this code is just, I mean, it takes an ingeniousness. I cannot imagine how someone who goes through this can figure out by themselves that this is what's going on. I can't compute that. I mean, my little brain cannot work that out. How someone who's going through this can experience that it is this that's going on? Because in each chitta, there's a sense of self. And each sense of self does everything that is necessary to not reveal itself to the mind or to the sense of self that was before it or after it, that it is different to the next one. And it does that perfectly. So in all that's going on, how can a mind come to awareness that this is actually what's going on here? I suppose that is what they call a Supreme Buddha. That wisdom. See, that is why it says the Buddha has six knowledges. They call it the Shad Asadharna Jnana. They are unique to Supreme Buddhas. These knowledges are unique to Supreme Buddhas. Not even Paccheka Buddhas nor Arahatta Buddhas can acquire these knowledges, because it requires the perfections to be perfected to its supremest. And one of them is anavarna jnana. The knowledge of unveiling. To be able to unveil all things. Therefore, nothing can be kept hidden to that mind. Not even what's going on in the mind itself. So I think, this is only my interpretation of what it takes to be a Supreme Buddha. I always wonder, how is it that the Buddha, having had no understanding of anicca, dukkha and anatta, made sense of all this? I mean, we have some sense of anicca, dukkha and anatta when it hurts our heads trying to get and make sense of all this. But then for someone who didn't have it in the first place, you know, we get the Dhamma and then through the Dhamma we try to see this. He saw this and then worked the Dhamma out through that. It's almost a miracle to me. It's like looking at the answer and working out a problem. Someone gives you the answer. You look at the answer sheet and work out a calculus problem from that. It's one problem to look at the problem and work out the answer. But this? So he came to a point where his mind, due to the sheer power and blessings of the merits he had acquired and the intensity of his practice as a bodhisattva of fulfilling the paramita, the mind had been developed to such an extent of purity and wisdom that there came a point where the mind could see what was going on within itself. So it's like we're always looking this way. One fine day someone looks like this. And then he realizes what's going on. That is the point where he becomes a Supreme Buddha. So the knowledge that he acquires by observing He then teaches us, because this is something that we will never be able to actually see within ourselves. You can understand it because I'm explaining this to you. But if you try to stop your mind and try and see all this working out, good luck. You tell me when that works out for you. But fear not, because sight is not what you need to become an arahant. Insight is what you need. As long as your mind, individual minds, your mind in general, as long as it understands this is the nature of what's going on, right? So because we are not trying to treat individual minds, we are trying to treat the mind in general. And that's what the Dhamma can do. So if it can do that, then there will come a point where one of these chittas will one day arise with wisdom of what's going on. So you see, even a sotapanna has not seen this through his, either through your physical eyes or even, through your mental eyes. It's not like that. They can only understand it through wisdom. It's conceptual, even to sotapanna. Even to the anagami individual or even to the arahant. Now, to the arahant, this doesn't happen. But let's take the anagami individual. They cannot see individual chittas and what's really going on there. It is only through wisdom, through insight, they know that this is what has been going on, this is what is going on, and this is what will happen. The ability to actually look at individual chittas, that is reserved to Buddhas. But that's okay, it just means our job is easier. Because all we have to do is learn and practice, not discover. We don't have to discover. I can't even begin to, I am not one who would ever make a determination to become a Supreme Buddha any day. Oh, no. One reason is it would be incredibly difficult to go throughout samsara to discover all this. And the second reason is, if you want to become a Supreme Buddha, your determination must be not only for myself, but for everyone in the whole universe, right? I will be the guide and I will take them across samsara with me. Right? Looking at you lot. So, arahat buddha is enough. When are you planning to come with me? Is my question to you. When are you planning to come with me? Life is too busy for you all. So that's why I'm not going to make such a resolve to be a Supreme Buddha. And then I have to take my Dharmeshwar Rajagirians with me, my troops. So I will tell you what I am doing, and I will ask of you to do what I am doing, right? And to come walk with me in the same direction. I just don't hold my hand and drag me back and say, Swaminathan, can you carry me across? I can't carry you across. I'm not that strong. I'm not strong enough to carry you across. But if you are walking, then I can walk with you. That I can do. Only Supreme Buddhas can carry us across. In other words, where there is no truth to discover it. And the other beautiful thing is this, ladies and gentlemen. I think you can only qualify to crack the code if you make a determination to do it not just for yourself, but for all universal beings. The universe only responds to that. To gift a mind with such supreme wisdom, right? To gift a mind, the universe has to make some decisions, right? Now, there's no doer in the universe either. But this is all how the system works, right? For the universe to decide whether someone qualifies to be a Supreme Buddha, I think in that mind there has to be a genuine intention that this is not a journey just for myself, but for all sentient beings, not just in the heavens, in the Brahmic abodes, but also in the four great hells. That level of compassion is just unfathomable. Even before becoming a Buddha is what I mean. I can understand the level of compassion I have right now because I am now in the Dhamma. But I'm talking about the Bodhisattva who is not in the Dhamma, because it is up to them to go discover it. So they cannot be in the Dhamma, can they? The only Dhamma they have is the Dhamma of wholesomeness. That's it. No noble Dhamma. No Arya Dhamma. So for someone just to be good, but then be good for everyone, universally, without discrimination, that's just unfathomable. Those are the makings of Supreme Buddhas. But you know, as we have been blessed with the teaching of a Buddha, we have already consumed half of this Buddha's dispensation. Less than half remains. You know this? Yeah. But it doesn't matter how long it remains if we die before that. And we all know that we are going to, you know, the sasana is always going to outlive us. None of us are going to live until the end of the sasana. So with our death will come the end of the sasana for us. This is why we have to be heedful in our practice. But you can't practice if you don't understand the principles, because these are not things you can discover by yourself. That is why you need someone to come and show these things to you. These are not truths you can discover by yourself. At least until you grasp the fundamental. Once you've grasped the fundamental anicca dukkha anatta, from there on you can work out of this all. So I cannot say that Guru Swami Nuhansa teaches me each and everything that I come and share with you here today. But the principle of the foundation of all this, that is what he taught me. That I could never have figured out by myself. Never. That always requires a teacher. And he could not have worked it out by himself. He needed a teacher. That's why it's called the Kalanavata. You cannot grasp that by reading the book, the scriptures. You can't grasp it or understand it by reading the Tripitaka even. It has to come from a teacher. That's why that noble lineage is essential for the sasana to prosper and prevail. But then once someone has got the basic fundamentals, from that you can build anything up. Then through that lens you start looking at the whole world. So if I gave an analogy for that as well, it's like I was blind once and Guru Swami Nuhansa gave me a pair of spectacles. So then I put it on and then now I go looking at the world. I might go places where he's not been. But I will always look at the world through the lenses that he's given me. These lenses I could not, I keep pointing at these metaphorically, but these lenses through which I see the world I could not have acquired by myself. There's only one individual who does that by themselves. Actually, there are two. The others are called the Paccheka Buddhas, they're called the Silent Buddhas. It is because it is for them, out of sheer merit, they get insight, but they don't go through the analysis of how it all worked out. They don't work out the calculations. They don't do the math behind it. They don't do the engineering behind it. It's like, you know, imagine if you got an honorary doctorate. Like if you got an honorary doctorate, you haven't done the work behind the doctorate, right? But you get it nonetheless and you're still called a doctor. That's a Paccheka Buddha. But they are deserving of it. It's honorary because they deserve the honor. They deserve the respect. They deserve the recognition, right? But then there are those who work for a PhD. Now, which of these can teach the discipline? The honorary doctor or the one who has worked for it? The one who's worked for it. That is the analogy. That is the similarity and the difference there. So the Paccheka Buddhas are like those with an honorary doctorate. The Sammasam Buddhas are like those individuals who have worked their way up from their undergrad, masters, all the way up to the PhD, and now they can teach anyone from grade 1 all the way up to getting their doctorate. Does that make sense? So this is the difference between the two of them. That's why you will not have students with the Paccheka Buddha, those who wish to get their degree, first degrees. Who are they? The Arahants. Right? Those who will qualify, graduate but they will only get their first degree. You will not have first degree holders who are students of Paccheka Buddhas, meaning honorary doctorates. You will not have, they won't have students working under them, reading under them to get a first degree. But you will have first degree holders who are students of individuals who've got their proper PhDs. So I have to bring today's world examples to explain to you the differences that are there in these things. So does that make sense now? So is it a self? No. But you heard the meow. No cat though. This is someone pretending to be a cat. That pretending to be a cat is the sense of self. This sense of self, why does it still feel like a self? Because the ingredients are the same. If the ingredients are the same, you cannot tell them apart. Because when two things are identical, how can you tell them apart? Right? So why is these experiences you can tell apart? How so? The doors change and the objects change. Right? So there's an infinite number of combinations there. Are there an infinite number of combinations for jati? No. There's only one ingredient or one set of ingredients for jati, one recipe. Therefore, always the product is the same. It's identical. Because it's identical, you can never tell one instance of jati from the next. This is why, although this is what's really going on, you feel that it is this. You really can't tell them apart. So now if I erase the differences, it looks like this, doesn't it? That's what it is. Okay. So that was a bit heavy today, I must admit. Merits, what can I do? Don't do merits then. Stop doing your merits and we won't need to talk about all these things. See, our Anagarika Mahatya asks me every morning, Swami Nasa, shall I put the candles out today? Shall I put the blocks out today? Shall I put the letters out today? Because I come, I think, right, I'm going to talk to them about this. On the way here, I tell him, Mahatya, can you please put the candle out? Can you put this out? Can you put that out? Because I have something in my mind I'm going to try and explain to them. But then I come here, do the precepting, and after that, we get carried away. This was not planned. None of these sermons were ever planned. But sometimes I bring these things, these props, in the hope that I will use one of them to explain a concept to you, but then we get carried away. But again, you know, we will come back to it one day. But one way or the other, you know, whether I use a prop or not, ultimately there's only one fundamental to get across to you. Anicca, dukkha, anatta. That's it. All of these exquisite explanations of all sorts of weird and wonderful descriptions of the Dhamma are essentially to give you this one core, one essence, anicca dukkha anatta. Once you grasp that, then the world's your oyster. That's it. Then you can work it out by yourself, the rest of it. But what comes after that is practice. Remember, your teacher cannot do that for you. There is no substitute for practice. No matter how good a teacher you have, even if you had the Buddha as your teacher, there is nothing that the Buddha could do to get you to practice. They can only motivate you, inspire you, instruct you. I suppose there would be one thing a Buddha could do, he would be able to check whether you're practicing right now. Examine your thoughts and tell you when you're not. Right? But this side of the Buddha, there's no one who can do that. So we are at a loss in that way. But then, you know, that's the only thing that we are missing. The extra bit we already have. So let's not cry over spilt milk, but rather be happy and grateful for all that we have. Let's call it a day. I do have one announcement to make. So we are going to be... Let me start again. Mahinda Thero and Bakula Theros will be visiting the UK in March. And so they'll be touring the UK from the 1st to the 25th of March. So if any friends, family, colleagues you may have there, they can join the various programs that they will be doing. Some of them will be in English, others will be in Sinhalese. I have the UK tour plan with me, which simply says the dates and which part of the country they'll be in. I'll read it out to you in case this is good to have on the video, in case you want to go back and watch it and capture those dates, but we'll also push this out as a flyer on the group. So they're going to be in Crawley from the 1st to the 3rd of March. They're going to be in Biggleswade from the 4th to the 6th of March. They're going to be in Harrow from the 7th to the 9th of March. In Hatfield from the 10th to the 11th of March. In Andover from the 12th to the 14th of March. In Leicester from the 15th to the 18th of March. In Manchester from the 19th to the 21st of March. And finally in West Wales from the 22nd to the 25th of March. This information we will push out on the group as well, so you have it and you can share it with anyone who you feel could benefit from this. Who could benefit from this? Merits. And pay attention. Some people have merits, but some have too big an ego that they don't want to pay attention. Or sometimes they think they know enough, or they think they know it all. The know-it-alls. When you're a know-it-all, it's very difficult to teach them, right? Yeah, so they have the merits, but only if they could shut down their internal voices and just listen to open-mindedly, they would understand it. But then they can't. Then there are others who are very keen. They really want to, but they simply don't have the merits. So you need these, both of these things. So if they don't have merits, it's our duty to try and somehow guide them to do more merits. And you can earn, the best ways to earn merits is to help those who are already doing the Dhamma. That's why, you know, if you can bring your children here, bring a friend, and if all they do is just set up the room and look after you all while you're here, fill a bottle up with water, or make sure that the washrooms are clean so that you can go and use them, or serve the sandwiches at the end of the afternoon. All of these things, ladies and gentlemen, are tremendous amounts of merits. You know, all this that people do, you all do, get together. The decorations that you do in the name of the sasana. Right? You may not be able to understand this, but why can't you decorate a flower vase? That's not rocket science. That's not difficult. Why can't you make sure that, you know, the power has been laid down? That's possible. You can make sure the washrooms are clean before our devotees go and use them, or that it's clean after they have used them. These are all merits. That's why I say one of the best ways to earn merits is to help those who have already acquired merits and therefore are already on the path. That's a very potent, an effective way of earning merits. It's what I do every day. That's why I share this with you. Pretty much any merit I do is actually for people who are already on the path. It's either for Swaminuhanses, Anagarikas or Anagarikas, Sri Rasravakas, Sri Rasravikas, Vaisis, or Upasakas and Upasikas. That's who I help, that's who I support, that's who I look after. So every single thing I do every day earns me the best kind of merits that is possible. That's why the sasana is called Punya Kettang Anuttara. You say that, right? Punya Kettang Anuttara, Dullabena Maya Laddha, and so on. It's also one of the virtues of the Sangha. Supadipanna Bhagavato Savaka Sangha. Nyaya patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho, samiji patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho, yadidan jattaya purusa yugani, atta purusa pukkala, esa bhagavato savaka sangho, ahuneyo, pahuneyo, dakkineyo, anjali karaniyo, anuttarang, punya kettang, lokassa. Anuttaram punyakyetan lokassa. Lokassa means to the world, of the world, belonging to the world, or for worldly beings. For worldly beings, the Sangha is an anuttara punyakyeta. An unequaled, that's what anuttara means, an unequaled field of merit. So the Sangha is an unequaled field of merit to worldly beings. We are all worldly beings, aren't we? Until you become an arahant, you are a worldly being. That is why the Buddha says, the Sangha is such that it is an unequaled field of merit for worldly beings. Therefore, sow your seeds there. Look after the crop. Water it. Fertilize it. Tend to it. And the rewards will be manifold. Let's leave it there. Okay, let's do the merit transfer and bring the sermon to a close. Let us all take a moment then to transfer the merits that we have all acquired today by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, by creating a conducive environment for all to come along and practice the path, as well as making offerings to the Noble Triple Gem, and inviting those that you have done to be here today with you to listen to the Dhamma, as well as inviting the Swami Master to deliver the sermon, listening to the sermon and contemplating on the teachings of the great Master. First and foremost, let us transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer this message to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us transfer this message to the Mahanayakas and the Anunayakas of all of the chapters throughout the world who have made it their life's purpose to protect and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us also transfer this message to my teacher Guru Swami Mahanse, as well as all the monks resident in the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us transfer this message to our devotees, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes all of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits. By the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments, overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer this message to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, our teachers and anyone and everyone who have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they also be freed from any physical and mental ailments and overcoming obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the Sakadeva, as well as all the gods and deities who have kept their promise to protect and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer these merits to the guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer these merits to our forefathers, our ancestors, those who passed away in our names, our loved ones, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life as we do. Let us also transfer this message to members of the armed forces, as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe. Let us transfer this message to those who lost their lives to natural disasters, such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that in this infinite long journey of samsara, they will all have been parents to us, siblings to us, friends to us. And with an abundance of compassion and loving kindness for all that they have done for us, let us transfer these merits to all. May by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful planes, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I and everyone who's helped make this program a success become a Arahatan Mahanse or an Arahat Theranin Mahanse in this very life itself and in the era of this Sri Sambuddha Sasana itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you.
Raga ginnen midetnva Dvesha ginnen midetnva Moha ginnen midetnva Nibbana parama sukhayen Sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayen Sukhita taravetnva Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satnvayo Nibbana parama sukhayen Sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayen Sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayen Sukhita taravetnva Raga gini niveva Dvesha gini niveva Moha gini niveva Nivan Sapalabheva Nivan Sapalabheva Nivan Sapalabheva
Thuruvange Suvishya Ananda Mahaguna Belen Siyalu Loka Siyalu Sattvayoma Nibbana Paramasukhen Sukhita Taravetva Sadhu, Sadhu, Sadhu.